Hello and welcome to this Book Hugger podcast. My name is George Miller, and my guest today is Stephen Asma, who has just published a book entitled On Monsters, An Unnatural History of Our Worst Fears. The book ranges in time from the chimeras of the ancient world to the post-human cyborgs of today and tomorrow. But it's much more than a mere catalogue of the stuff of our nightmares. Stephen is interested in pursuing the content and, crucially, the meaning of those nightmares. So in the ancient world, a monster could be one of nature's playthings, a source of wonder. But to the medieval Christians, monsters had to serve some purpose of an omnipotent deity, however hard that purpose might be to divine. And by the Romantic Age, a monster could serve as a warning of man's hubris in trying to play God through the agency of science. So many monsters, many meanings. When I spoke to Stephen on the phone just before Christmas, I began by asking him to explain why it was so hard to define what exactly a monster is.
Yeah, I guess there's a sort of traditional view in philosophy, which is my own background, about what concepts mean. And the traditional view is that there should be some sort of defining criteria that all, in this case, all monsters would have. And what I find is not that that doesn't really obtain in the case of monsters. What you have are sort of what Wittgenstein would have called a family resemblance. Some monsters seem like other monsters in the sense that they, you know, they can't be negotiated with, they're irrational. Other monsters seem like another group of monsters. And we have this sort of general family of creatures and ideas that sort of passes as monstrous. And in the book, I'm trying to trace what some of those similarities are and what some of the differences are. And when you think of it in that way, it allows you to focus in on what you might, what the ancients thought of as omens or prodigies. Let's say a child is born, a conjoined twin, what we can call Siamese twins oftentimes. And so the monster epithet was applied in that case. But in our own day and age, you find that monster is sort of hurled around in the press with regard to psychopaths and psycho killers. And so the term can function in all these different domains. It could be biological, it could be artistic, it could be even ethical.
But one characteristic that you note is its ubiquity. It's impossible really to come up with a society or a time where there hasn't been some notion of the monster. You put it rather elegantly. You say perhaps monsters are part of our furnished mind.
Yeah, there's increasing evidence from the evolutionary psychologists that the human mind has some furniture in it that is probably evolved there as a result of our encounter with predators and prey, you know, out on the African savanna. And some theories hold that some of our fears, and particularly like the extreme forms like phobias, are probably hardwired, or at least they're based on some hardwired fears. Like, for example, many, many people, in fact, it seems to be universally the case that people are afraid of spiders. And some evolutionary psychologists, some biologists suggest that it was probably advantageous to be worried about poisonous spiders as we evolved, as our sort of ancestors evolved, because having that kind of dramatic response to creepy crawlies may have led one to live on and procreate. So it could have been actually selected for over time.
And monsters simultaneously repel us, but also attract us. That's part of their fascination. We can't stop looking, can we? I mean, that's made very clear by all the illustrations in your book. It's very hard to look away, and yet there many of them are repugnant.
Yeah, that's right. There is something that both, as you say, repels and attracts, and that seems to be one of the more universal aspects of the monstrous. It's sort of, if you look at it in different times, it sort of falls out differently. I think our current day and age is really obsessed with sort of zombies and vampires and serial killers. And I think there's something in the monstrous that represents our sort of primordial, primitive, sort of pre-civilized self. You know, if we could sort of think about Freud's view of the person, he says, well, you've got all these sort of dangerous drives and, you know, id-like cravings, murderous aggression within you, and you learn to sort of basically repress all this in order to be a socialized, functioning human being. And the monster is sort of like a little even you think about the monster movies or monster literature, it's a little holiday for the id. You get to go and have this bit of freedom where you let your wild things off the chain and they can howl at the moon, and then you get them back in and you can go on with your quiet repressed life after that.
You get to play with the demon, but then you get to put it back in the bottle afterwards.
Yeah, that's one way to think about the attraction repulsion. The other way is that oftentimes monsters cross these boundaries, you know, these taxonomic boundaries. Mm. When you think about the chimera of the ancient world, minotaurs and satyrs and the griffin, for example, and it's a combination of maybe two different kinds of animals, or it's some hybrid creature. And there also seems to be something very attractive about that. You know, here's a creature that doesn't fit in our normal sort of cognitive classification system, and it actually creates arousal. They call this sort of cognitive mismatch. Mm. So there's, even though it's sort of horrifying, it's also something that you're very curious about and attracted to.
Is that the same thing as category jamming? I was interested in that concept of something that doesn't make sense, and again, we can't sort of stop looking at it.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's an interesting phrase that they've come up with to describe, you know, we have these categories that we use to make sense out of the world. You know, this is a quadruped, this is a creature that flies, here's a bird that lives in the water. And what monsters do is that they sort of represent these blended or strange crossing of these categories, and so it's been called category jamming, where you have like, well, it's, you know, one thinks about this creature in the Alien series that, you know, grabs onto your face and wraps around your neck, and it looks sort of like a spider mixed with a snake, which is a pretty horrifying combination of phobias. And that is, many sort of psychologists and philosophers have said, well, that's one of the things that really arouses intellectual and cognitive interest, is stuff that crosses these boundaries. So boundary crossers or category jammers.
I was also fascinated by what you said about simulated human beings in video games and how we sympathize with them as they become more and more human-like, up until a certain point, and then I think it's been called the uncanny valley, where they're just a sort of step away from being human, but still not quite human, and then we have a real problem with them.
Yeah, that's right. That's a phenomenon that, we've got more and more data on it now because people are doing empirical research, but it goes back to Freud's idea of the uncanny, which is something that is almost right, but not quite. And you do think about the CGI effects in films and in video games, where, you know, the thing looks quite human, but then the mouth or the eyes don't quite seem correct, and that gives one a very troubled feeling. It's a strange mood that people report, and the psychologists have given this the term uncanny. And I find that monsters, as a general sort of genre, in film and in literature and in visual art, oftentimes tries to exploit some of that subtle psychological mood. You know, I mean, fear is one thing. You can just have somebody chasing you with a chainsaw or something.
Yeah.
But then there's the more eerie sort of David Lynchian kind of experiences. And these kind of elicit more of this more subtle psychological experience, the uncanny.
I wanted to go back, Stephen, briefly to the Middle Ages, because I was really interested in what you said about that age and how there was a real quest for the meaning of monsters, because when you live in a monotheistic world where you believe in a creator god, then of course every manifestation in that world must have some god-created meaning. And I found that a fascinating section of the book, how the medieval world tried to reconcile their belief in monsters with that view of a world created by God.
Yeah, there was a whole monsterology, if we can put it that way, before Christianity and before monotheism. And there it wasn't quite as problematic because, as you say, the belief was by the ancient Greeks, for example, that there was all kinds of crazy stuff living in other parts of the world. And basically, they had their own monstrous gods, or you had a sort of polytheistic view of theology anyway. So there weren't sort of all good gods or one all good god to reconcile monsters with. But as you say, in the medieval world, you had this transition to monotheism. And here you find the patristic, you know, the church fathers doing backflips trying to figure out, well, two monsters fit in to this notion of an all-good God, because here you have some heinous creatures, legendary creatures in the medieval world were like the Blemmii, which were these headless creatures with their mouths and their eyes sort of in their chest, or the Cynocephalus, which were dog-headed creatures. The belief was that these lived out in Africa and in India. And so the idea was, well, and giants were also sort of a major theme in the medieval world. Why did God either create these things, or at least why did God let them go around doing their nefarious activities, or at least why did he allow them to be so horrific? And you find somebody like Augustine, for example, is arguing that, well, we're not sure whether these monsters can be saved, whether they'll be able to go to the, you know, the beatific vision with the rest of us. And so I find him trying to find criteria as to whether these will be able to be capable of redemption. And if the monsters can be redeemed, then we need to go out and spread the good news and basically take a missionary attitude towards them. Whereas many others, I think, in the medieval world interpreted them as, well, these are basically the devil's handiwork, and God allows them to act, sort of operate in the world as a way in which to dispense his own divine justice. So devils, demons, witches, and monsters are basically punishing the wicked. And so that was a way to reconcile the monstrous with an all-good God.
You write about Frankenstein as really the most famous monster of the last 200 years. And I wondered if you felt he represented a new type of monster that could only have been begotten in the scientific age, or does he have antecedents in earlier centuries too?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, there are antecedents, sort of direct ones, like the Jewish legend of the golem, is a creature in which the rabbi of Prague in the medieval period creates a creature from the dirt, and then animates it by writing truth on its forehead in Hebrew, and this brings it alive, and it crashes about, and it's designed to help save and protect Jews living in the ghetto in Prague at the time, but it goes haywire and can't be controlled, and it's too strong for its own good. So there are sort of predecessors to the Frankenstein view of sort of animated monster, but I think that's right. There is something very I think unique to the scientific era when you think about Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, because in many ways it represents a lot of the fears that arise after the scientific revolution, and thinking about life as being sort of mechanical. Well, you get the right kind of parts together and you jolt it with some electricity and you're going to be able to get the thing alive and running around, and that was a sort of operating premise in the scientific era. And you have Galvani doing experiments with frogs' legs and electricity. And Descartes and that whole tradition tends to think of the body as a machine. So I think Frankenstein really taps into the romantic kinds of fears about that reductionistic science, you know, and shows us, well, here's what can happen if we do think of ourselves too much as just material, mechanical systems. We're going to end up creating things that we can no longer control, and there's fears that we've sort of desacralized, you know, life itself and that kind of thing, and they all come to the fore in Frankenstein.
Stephen, I really admired the illustrations of the book, although, as I mentioned, some of them are quite gruesome to look at, and I was also very taken with the fact that you yourself had produced many of the illustrations, and I wondered, did that allow you to approach the subject in a different sort of way, or a different mode of understanding, by sitting down with your pen and ink and actually drawing some of these creatures, these nightmares?
Yeah, I hadn't thought of it that way, but I suppose that it must be true that my own fascination with monsters is probably based on my love of visual art, and I've sort of been drawing creatures and other things since I was a kid, and so I suppose that was my early romance with the monsters. And so I guess I think of them visually, and I find that that's a way in which to depict some of this category jamming that we were talking about.
Yes.
Because you can really see, okay, here's why it's sort of part lion and part eagle, or whatever in the case of the griffin. And so it's exciting, and I also think there's actually a beautiful and disturbing pictorial tradition of monsters that if you look at Albrecht Dürer's etchings, you know, the great German etching artist, you find some amazing, and Hieronymus Bosch, for example, you know, there is a wonderful pictorial tradition, and I feel that artists have been interested in monsters and the sort of underbelly of the human psyche for a long time before the scientists managed to sort of get some traction there.
I was also struck by the fact you talked about, at one point, the fact in Shakespeare's time, in his audience, you would have had a range of responses to the monstrous and the supernatural, which would have ranged from entire credulity to outright skepticism. And at the end of the book, you talk about our contemporary playful mania for marvels and monsters. But at the same time, you also talk about the fact that many people in the world, including in advanced industrial countries, believe in demonic possession. And I wondered if you felt that in some ways we haven't actually changed all that much in our attitude to the monstrous.
Yeah, that's a good point. We do tell ourselves this story in the West about kind of like a staircase of progress in which, you know, in the old days people believed in crazy supernatural stuff, and but now after the scientific revolution and certainly now in our developed prosperous status, we don't have these same kinds of supernatural fears. And it turns out that that's true for maybe a small portion of the population. And I think that may have always been true of a small portion of the population. One looks back at Aristotle, for example, and then he's quite different from many of his contemporaries. But I do think there is, in fact, probably just as much anxiety and fears about the supernatural and the monstrous as there was in the medieval era. We tend to look back on that era and say, well, it was a wash in, you know, it was the Dark Ages, it was a wash in superstition. I think if you look more carefully at our own culture, you'll find that it's also a wash in superstition, but it's maybe just a little more sophisticated in the way it's presented. There's actually, in the States, you know, in the Bible Belt, there's in fact a huge amount of really literal belief in the power of the devil who possesses people, and that demon possession is real and not some figurative and metaphorical sort of phenomenon. Whereas for myself and, you know, the professor colleagues of mine, this seems very arcane and hard to believe. So you find that the culture is layered almost like, you know, the stratum, and you can find the most sort of credulous beliefs existing, you know, in the same city here with some of the most scientific and rational sort of beliefs as well.
The last thing I wanted to ask you, Stephen, was one thread which runs all the way through the book is the fact that the monster or the monstrous is an embodied phenomenon. And I wondered, as we look at the things which we find frightening today, such as biotech and changing climate, do you think that we may be moving into an era where the monstrous becomes disembodied wholeheartedly for the first time?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that's right. With fears about artificial intelligence, and the idea of a system that could be monstrous, you do find something, I think, new. And I try to trace this at one point in the book where we now think, for example, in the 20th century, that it's not just sort of individual creatures or heinous psychopaths that are monstrous, but we think that whole societies and civilizations and institutions can actually be monstrous. They can actually dehumanize people to such a degree that they actually churn out monsters. One thinks about some of the worst kinds of penitentiaries, for example, could be monstrous institutions. And if that's true, then it's sort of a short step from there, I think, to the kind of thing you're suggesting, which is that you could have a kind of, I don't know, it's sort of diffuse notion of monster. It's not sort of isolatable in any particular individual, but it could be a whole way of thinking, and perhaps even the whole culture could embody certain monstrous values. And that's something that sort of gives us a chill, I think, about the future.
I was talking to Stephen Asmer, whose On Monsters, An Unnatural History of Our Worst Fears, is out now in hardback from Oxford University Press.